We welcome you to session 231, entitled Why I Stay. If you want to be someplace else, why now's a good time to choose and leave and go someplace else. You can't hear me? Is this better? Okay, I'll try and do it that way. The standard warnings are, if you've got cell phones or other noisemakers, turn them off. We have five participants in this, and they know the time limits they have. Each one of them has the same time limit, and I guess this is being recorded both on tape as well as on a digital, some kind of a digital deal we've gotten somewhere. I'm not sure where all that is, but this session is the fifth year we've had this in a row, and it's an opportunity for us to hear from people who are pretty much like most of you here, I think. I'm on both sides of this, and it's where people who have had some serious issues with their religion, the way it's practiced and the administration of it, or some things like that, or the doctrine. There are conflicts in the scriptures, whatever it might be. And with all of that, they still have been involved heavily in their church and church callings and things they've done in the church, and made a real contribution. And I think hearing these stories of people who have lifetime of doing this, I think is very, very faith inspiring for me, because they address a lot of the same issues I have and issues that I keep coming up with. They somehow seem to help me through them each year when I'm here. So that's why we have this session, and we're very fortunate to have five very illustrious and accomplished people in the different areas, and I will introduce them all at once, and then they'll come up in the order in which I name them. Our first presenter will be Art Wiskum. Art started life out in the Uinta Basin, which is, I don't think we've ever had anybody from the Uinta Basin before, Art. His education was at BYU, then at the University of Chicago, and also at the University of Colorado, Columbia, and Harvard. As professionally, he served in administrating the school systems, working in other government agencies. He was superintendent of schools here in Salt Lake for a while in the 60s, I believe, and then he moved to the Midwest and was worked in different areas there. He's the father of six children, the grandfather of 35, and he tells me the full component of his family exceeds 80 when you count all the people that are out there. Our next presenter will be Charlotte England, known to most of you. She is an artist, a chef, a musician, a mother of six, and a grandmother of 15, extraordinary. She was a member of the Sunstone Board for several years, and she started her sort of life as a missionary to Samoa with her husband, the legendary Gene England. She didn't finish her mission. She had duties of motherhood call her that got her home early, but Jean stayed there and finished it out for him. Third is a unique presenter to us here. He is not of our LDS faith, but he is certainly a fellow of LDS Church, but a fellow traveler with us in our faith, Bill Russell. He's been with us here year after year. I think he's been coming Sunstone longer than I have. And
how many?
23, right? That's about when I started, too. Anyway, he's been a professor of American history at Graceland College in Lamoni, Iowa. He's been affiliated with all of the Mormon history groups and things like that. He's president of the Mormon History Association and the John Whitmer Historical Association. He's written several books on both religious books as well as, I call them, political books about the Community of Christ, or the Reorganized Church as it was called then. He's an active elder in the Community of Christ. When you get old like this, don't they make you high priest?
They probably won't.
Well, I see. Okay. I think in our outfit, I think in our outfit, you'd probably be a high priest. But Anyway, he's married and has two children, two stepchildren. We worked with, lives with. Our fourth presenter is Karen Rosenbaum, someone I've been trying for about 4 years to get to perform this task, and she's finally here. Karen grew up in Salt Lake here, went to the University of Utah, then got a master's degree at Stanford, and her mentor there was the legendary Wallace Stegner. She's taught at Ohlone College in, what's the town in the East? Okay, in Fremont in the East Bay for many, many years. She's married to Ben McClinton, and she has been the editor of a weekly newsletter for the Berkeley Ward for decades now. Yeah, okay. Our fifth presenter is Duane Jeffrey. He emerged from Delta, Utah, so we've got two small Utah town boys here, two small town Utah boys today that have made good when they left. He got his undergraduate degrees in up at Utah State, and then he had a master and a PhD from Cal at Berkeley. Professor of biology at BYU, and he's been very notable for championing the opening of minds to the idea that maybe there's something to evolution, and he's can quote verbatim everything the first presidents have ever said on the subject, and comes to the conclusion that they have said it's not a decision we're making, you've got to decide for yourself. I think that's it. And he's in church service, he's a returned missionary, he's been in bishoprics, high councils, he's a teacher, he's married, has three daughters and six grandchildren. So with that, we'll proceed, and Art, you take off.
Yes, I grew up in the suburbs of Lizard Gulch, Utah. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has given us the greatest pioneer legacy since Moses led his people out of Egyptian bondage. The Great Trail of the Mormon Era led from Liverpool, England, lo, those thousands of miles into the western sunsets of the Great Basin Kingdom. Hundreds turned to thousands, joined the march in search of a Zion that would be. The able and well-to-do came side by side with those with nothing but their fondest hopes and dreams. From 1856 to 1860, nearly 3,000 Latter-day Saints pulled their earthly possessions in wheel carts 1,300 miles from Iowa City to the Salt Lake Valley. My own grandfather went to the famous dock in London to bid the Mormon missionaries returning to America goodbye. Using his own method, he became a stowaway. Once at sea, he reported to the captain for duty. Recently, we located the ship Hudson's typewritten manifest. At the bottom of the formal document, the ship's captain penned the following: six babies born at sea, William Fleet Wiscombe, age 18, assigned to the kitchen. On this great and glorious pioneer trail, babies were born in the most crude of obstetrical conditions. Many who were already ill and worn were buried in shallow graves. This modern exodus helped place several new stars in the American flag. Some 375 communities were established, from Juarez, Mexico, to Cardston, Canada. Most of those have survived to this day. A grand legacy, indeed. Our missionary force is the largest and most efficient the world has ever known. They come as legions from many of the best homes on the face of the earth, ranging from 55,000 to 60,000, serving at their own expense or that of their families. Is the effort substantial? Added up, 400 per month times 12, 4,800 per year. Double this for 2 years of service, times 55,000 in the field after 24 months. Start adding it up all over again. Out of our little posterity of 80 souls, we have sent missionaries all over the world, to Russia, Australia, Sweden, Spain, Japan, England, Budapest, Korea, Jamaica, Venezuela, and so it goes. In a time when vast numbers of youth are caught up in the permissive life of illusionary waste, when college binge drinking parties have become a major problem for university administrators, when celebrity, for its own sake, can dominate the national news, for weeks on end, our army of missionaries quietly go forth. These youth return from their spiritual service filled with the desire to move their lives onward and upward. Their hearts are full of love for everyone they meet, and their desire to serve humanity is not lost in want. A grand legacy, indeed. In the approaching 80th year of my life, I've tried all my adult days to be an objective student of the prophet Joseph Smith. His contributions amazed me. The restoration seemed like an optimistic response to an earlier apostasy. Perhaps one of his most vital contributions was to return God within time and space, where the ancient Christian creeds had removed him, rendering him, in the words of William James, less fit for religious purposes. In the world's attempt to make God more and other than what he was and is, they disembodied him and thus made him less, removing him too far from the human struggle. Nietzsche declared that God was dead. He did not mean that God did not exist, but that the councils and the creeds and the masses had killed him for practical religious purposes. Joseph said that we are genetically related to God. Amazing as this might appear to the world, Joseph did not stop here. He further declared that we, the children of the gods, are not totally God's creation, that our intelligence is co-eternal with God, that God's perfection grew out of his earlier limitations, thus tempering and conditioning his omnipotence. Thus came unto earth the most profound of all religious and theological teachings. We are free agents. We can literally write our history up or down. God's interest out of love is that of assisting us toward immortality and eternal lives. Joseph, perhaps without even knowing it, resolved the most perplexing problem in all Western theological discourse, the problem of evil. God neither created good or evil. In these teachings, the dignity, the nobility of humankind has never shone with brighter radiance. This profundity came from a youth with a third-grade formal education. Each of us has been blessed with the two greatest teachers the world has ever known, good and evil. Who among us is wise enough to know which has been the more effective teacher in helping, in assisting us in being who we now are and may yet become? Joseph opened, refined, translated, and vastly expanded our scriptural canon, promising many additional records already written, with many more yet to be written for our growth and for our edification. Joseph opened up a vast cosmology in declaring that God had created worlds without number, and that these inhabitants by life and were inhabited by life and passion and achievement in countless numbers to mortals. Joseph's message turned a religious movement to a people bent on creating a Zion community with our hearts, minds, and bare hands. He built temples, conversed with angels, received priesthoods, created cities, governments, worldwide missions, and gatherings. He gave us a law of health, drug-free, and a vision of personal fidelity. He organized the kingdom of God on earth with five others, now grown to millions, declaring that would eventually fill the entire earth. Joseph obliterated the fear and terror of death, gave us the King Follett Discourse, informed us that knowledge, intelligence, and wisdom gained here will rise with us in the resurrection. He taught us to judge less and love more. It seems to me we, at this point in time, we've got an avalanche of hate in God's dysfunctional family. He informed us that families and love relationships will be with us until time is no more. He defined hell, the celestial domain, as a kingdom of infinite glory. From a solitary jail cell, he gave us poetry sufficient to bring us to tears. Best of all, he gave us a profound meaning and reason to live. A grand legacy indeed. The freshness, logic, and openness of the restoration was in stark contrast with the traditional dogma compounded. Ecclesiastical legalism chained in absolutisms, being the grand inquisitor's gift of security and certitude in exchange for personal freedom and individual responsibility. Against the fixations of Sir Isaac Newton's mechanical universe came new voices in theoretical physics declaring an open universe, a cosmos in continuous flux. Albert Einstein, Max Planck, Werner Heisenberg, and proposed relativity and quantum mechanics and thus opened up new doors and windows to the universe. Contributing to all this thought in the modern age came three philosophical systems: existentialism, pragmatism, and process philosophy, each with its core idea already announced by Joseph Smith. Existentialism places great stress upon the importance of the individual and upon individual freedom and responsibility. Soren Kierkegaard represented the Christian version, Jean-Paul Sartre the agnostic of the secular view. Camus and Sartre had their falling out over the priority of essence versus existence. Joseph Smith could have explained that they were both right because these are joined. If God had created the intelligence of humankind, then essence would precede existence. This he did not do, we therefore could not exist. So here is existentialism leading us back as a world culture to the revelations of Joseph Smith. The most existential statement of the Doctrine and Covenants is the declaration of God that it is not meet that I should command in all things, but be anxiously engaged in a good cause and do many things of your own free will and individual responsibility. Go forth and meet the moral imperative, because the power is within you. That is, you can hear God saying, don't come crying with parched tongue for me, begging me to tell you what I want you to be. Be a loving person. Be a sympathetic person. Be a culturated person. Be an informed person. Be a loving person. Be a noble and embraceable person, and surprise the hell out of both of us. Pragmatism, an American-born philosophy, resulted from the thought of Pierce, James, and Dewey. Here, the core idea is experience. The truth of religious experience is its pragmatic value. Does it work? What are the results? William James Penn, no particular results then so far, but only an attitude of orientation is what the pragmatic method means. The attitude of looking away from first things, principles, categories, supposed necessities, and of looking toward last things, fruits, consequences, facts. Again, pragmatism is leading us back to the revelations of Joseph Smith. From December to April of 1839, Joseph languished in the Liberty Jail. His lament was born of despair. Why was he the leader in jail with such mob violence being inflicted on his people? With government sanction from the creator of this earth came the great declaration of the metaphysics of experience. All these things, my son, shall be for thy experience and for thy good. Lastly, process philosophy resulting from the observations of Alfred North Whitehead and his brilliant student, Charles Hartshorne. Whitehead's Gifford Lectures are considered to be the high water mark of metaphysical thought of the 20th century. Hartshorne insists that at its very ground, the world is a moving and a dynamic, rather than a static and emotionless being. He attacks the traditional religious view of theological absolutism with its corollary of God's omnipotence. He holds with current physics that reality consists of events, not things. God is a mover, not an unmoved mover, as Aristotle of theological tradition described him. He does not possess total foreknowledge of particulars. Human freedom and the world's contingency are not limitations on God's perfection, but only on the absolutism of his power. God is, for Hartshorne, both finite and infinite, perfect but also perfectible. God and man are not being that is fixed and frozen, but in process of becoming, that is, changing and adaptable. The universe is in constant change and flux, Whitehead said. His greatest wisdom insight came the day he learned that Newton's mechanical bound universe was wrong. Relativity in the new science and quantum mechanics had come of age. In his amazing contribution to modern thought of the world, Whitehead saw the mortal task of getting our hands into the hands of God so that together we can work on the same team in assisting the deliberative forces of the universe to prevail over the arbitrary. Process philosophy is basically a Christian theism. Whitehead believed in God as surely as did Hartshorne. This philosophy takes into account modern science and its findings. It declares that God's way of working in the world is a slow process, patiently overcoming the elements of chance and evil present in the universe. The emphasis on God's involvement rather than on his absolutism and total self-sufficiency. It is an emphasis on God's love for his children rather than on his absolute omnipotence. Contributing to all this modern thought is expressed in existentialism, pragmatism, and process philosophy are a number of the most brilliant and highly educated minds of the modern age. In each of these thought systems are core ideas found in Joseph's revelations and sermons. Did any of these profound intellects noted above know that these fundamental ideas were presented to the world by Joseph Smith? Likely not. So how did Joseph Smith, who never lived to see his 39th birthday, get so far ahead of everyone so early? The answer to me is obvious. He had celestial help. So why have I stayed? Simply for myself and for a rapidly growing posterity and for a glorious legacy of faith. I did not wish to deny to my own or to theirs, the last generation, the wondrous clods provided my roots. After that, I wished for faith, knowledge, and human enlightenment to give them wings. I wanted them all to know the necessity of a good marriage for all the odd couples, credulity and skepticism, liberalism and conservatism, faith and reason, belief and doubt, stability and change, for all these polarities are but two wings of the same bird. for people to achieve their goals, organization is required. Such creates institutions. Institutions large spawn bureaucracies. Bureaucracies by our habit and nature often destroy the very goals originally sought. The great challenge is whether or not the institutional church in patience and love can remain loyal to its open beginnings, or whether it will, out of fear, regress to rigidity and fixed certitudes that limit the expansion of truth. There is Joseph Smith's message to the world, that God has returned and is one with us, marching in the mortal muck and mire and grime of life, passionately engaged in the process of turning chaos into order and into beauty. With love and an everlasting adoration for each of us, he invites our cooperation and our participation in this glorious venture. He wanted each of us to have an everlasting love affair with Plato's trilogy, the good, the true, and the beautiful. The goodness of all this shines forth for me as the luminous luster of the evening star.
I found out that the margins on my computer left all the words off on the right side. So there might be some strange things. Okay. The question I asked myself when Toby asked if I'd be on this panel was, why wouldn't I stay? That response seems to be a bit short, so I made a lot of notes this month about stories that I have lived. Putting these notes together, I realize they're mainly about community and about jumping off. My church community and social life were directly integrated growing up in Salt Lake City. Most of my friends were Mormon, but I was fortunate enough to have my Catholic friend Wendy up the street and Valerie, who I didn't learn was Jewish or what that meant for years after being childhood friends, and a third friend across the street who I don't ever recall seeing in church. Our family attended church about a mile and a half away until a new one was built just around the corner from our house. We had all contributed to the ward budget and actively participated in the building of the small, by today's standards, neighborhood chapel. Even we children played a part in it, helping with clearing up the field for planting grass and giving our few cents toward the building fund. Ward dances were held almost weekly after MIA, with Brother Condi furnishing ice cream from his shop, a fitting business for someone who always seemed happy. I remember reaching down into the deep 5-gallon containers when I was helping scoop one of our favorite flavors and getting a whiff of something that made me feel a little lightheaded. It was peach brandy. In the words of Garrison Keillor, it was a community of good, ordinary people who would give the shirt off their back if needed. It was here between family and church that I heard the lessons and warnings of choosing between right and wrong. I must have taken the lessons on faith quite literally, because I tested it out at the early age of 9 or 10 when I climbed on the top of our garage and, holding tight to an open umbrella, jumped off the roof. I hit the ground hard, and when the umbrella didn't break my fall, of course, and came away slightly dazed and bruised, but not broken, except perhaps my ego. It was truly and literally my first leap of faith. Little did I know that from that experience, my life would continue to be a series of leaps of faith that would lead to unimaginative adventures. My church horizons broadened enormously years later, and by 1954, Gina and I were making a huge jump together. We were married only a few months when we were called to serve a mission to the Samoan Islands in the Pacific. We sold our car that would help cover the cost of $40 a month for most of our 2.5 years, and started filling 2 old trunks that we borrowed from our parents with the required list of things we would need, including bedding, pots and pans, teaching aids for children. I even put in a whole bunch of socks. Now, we're going to an island where they don't wear shoes or socks. And I thought, I don't know what I'm going to do with these, but I took them anyway, and we ended up making stocking dolls for Christmas. By the 9th of June, we were on the train waving goodbye to our friends, family from the back of the caboose as we pulled out of the Union Pacific Station in Salt Lake City. We would share the trip with 14 other missionaries who were going to Australia and New Zealand. After several days on the water, we made a stop in Hawaii for refueling and supplies, allowing us to hire a taxi with some of the missionaries and explore the island. A few more days on the water, and Jean and I were deposited in Suva, Fiji, where we would wait for 10 days for a freighter to take us to Samoa. Standing on the dock with our trunks and suitcases, we again waved goodbye to our good friends that we had made on the trip by then, who are now singing to us from the boat as they pulled away from the dock, leaving us in the strange new land. As we looked about in the evening light, orienting ourselves to a new place, a young Indian boy approached us and asked if we were Mormon missionaries. His name was Ajid. We introduced ourselves, and he asked if we had a place to stay. We told him we were about to look for one. Ajit, a stranger, was inviting us to be a part of his community during our short stay to Fiji. He had met some missionaries and fell in love with the gospel. His one contact with the church was finding the missionaries when the boats arrived. Later we went to his home for tea, later on in the story, one evening where his parents welcomed us and served us delicious Indian food, my first taste of curry. But after his mother continued waiting on us, I asked Ajit if his mother would join us. He said she didn't speak English and it was the custom for her to serve. It was a custom I never felt comfortable with, but one which we would experience again in Samoa. Back to the dock, we're standing there, and Ajit said, "Come with me." He said he had led us to a taxi that would take us and our belongings to a small house outside the town where the Smith family lived. This would be our home for the next 10 days. Mr. Smith was a widower from New Zealand. He had married a young Polynesian girl who cared for their children, including their new little boy. They took us in like family, introducing us to some foods that would become our staples in Samoa, especially taro, a root vegetable that was oftentimes used in the sacrament as a substitute for bread, because they didn't have that bread. Sunday morning, Brother Smith directed all of us into their living room or parlor, where I assumed we would have a service. During our 1 week of training in the old mission home on North Temple in Salt Lake, we had heard of cottage meetings or small branch meetings held in the homes of the saints. Now we would partake of that spirit we had heard about. Well, to our surprise, Brother Smith turned to us and said, "Okay, Elder and Sister England, you are in charge. Now you teach us." So for the hour or so, we scrambled to recall as much as we could about primary lessons and songs, pulling out scriptures and stories. We hoped to leave something for them to hold on to until the next missionaries came through. Our initiation was quick, but the Smiths were patient with us. The experience served, though, as a warning for impromptu speaking for the future. It was a sad parting when we left the struggling little family and Ajit, who had been so attentive to us, to finish our journey to Samoa. A freighter named the Matua carried us across the rough waters for 2 days, and we had the first view of the islands early in the morning. We were in the harbor of Pasing on the island of Upolu. President Stone and his wife met us and took us ashore in a motorboat. After showing us a little of the small harbor town, we settled for a couple of days with the missionaries and received our assignment, which was to teach in the village in Viola on the large and primitive island of Savai'i. Before leaving early the next morning, we attended church, a little branch a few miles from the mission home. Never before have I heard a congregation sing with the energy and sound that came from that group of saints that Sunday morning. I've heard of being lifted off your seats, and I felt that was really happening. We were treated like long-lost relatives with the greetings and the feastings. One thing that was going to take some getting used to was seeing the kids bathing in the river that provided us with the water for the sacrament earlier in the day. The next morning, a small boat took us to the other island where some poorly nourished horses were saddled with saddlebags carried us from the coast to the top of the mountain that was once a volcano. As we slowly rode up the hill into the lush forest and jungle, I felt that I was truly on another planet. The reality of it all was just beginning to sink in. The horse plodded along the dirt path with a kind of rhythm, almost matching my thought rhythm. I can do this. I can do this. I can do this. Not knowing just what it was that I would be required to do, other than teaching people of the village and learning from them, including the language. The elders taught us the Samoan words for the trees and the bats that hung from them and plants and animals along the trail. But jet lag, the heat and humidity, along with the rocking motion of the horse, made memorizing slow for the moment, almost falling off the horse. So tired. We arrived at the old termite eaten house, built nearly a century before, that would be our home for the next 6 months. There was no electricity. Our water came off the roof into a rain barrel, and we shared the house with four elders. Three who ran the church coconut plantation, and Elder Hanks, who was principal and teacher at the school. It was very new for me. We settled into our teaching routine, worked with branch presidents, visited people in a village close by where the swallows swooped down every evening around the Follies, which is a Samoan house, at dusk. It created a most peaceful environment that I still feel when I see swallows. I studied the language each morning, combining it with scripture study by translating the Pearl of Great Price. We all had this morning study together. Scrubbed our clothes on a washboard and draped them over the bushes to dry. Gene found some wood to cut for an ironing board, and we shared the ironing job with him sitting on the square end of the board to anchor it down on the table. I used a propane iron on the other end while he read to me. We both benefited, and it's always been a pleasant memory for me. We also had a small first aid station. Using the few resources we had to bandage and disinfect boils and minor wounds, or larger ones from encounters with a wild boar. There were always new challenges that kept us mindful of why we were there and pushed us to find creative ways that worked for the better of the Samoan people who we had come to cherish. A couple of months into our teaching, Gene contacted a rash on his hand, possibly a rash reaction from the chalk we used in the school. I tried to clear it up with the remedies we had. What seemed a simple irritation was developing into an infection. Tiny blisters formed, and I bathed his hand in the solution that I hoped would keep the infection from spreading further. One morning, when he didn't feel up to teaching, I was changing the dressing before leaving to take care of our classes. When I turned his hand over, I saw two red veins going up his arm to the lymph nodes. He had blood poisoning. This can't be, flashed through my head. Not here. Not now. Away from a doctor. Away from a hospital. I felt like the world we were in was crashing in on us. The decayed old house, the lush jungle, the village, the people, all seemed oppressive. I asked myself, what are we doing here? I was looking for a direction, a voice to tell me what else I could do to erase the poison. I begged, please, dear God, please don't leave us alone. Fasting and praying never carried the meaning it did for the next 3 days, when somehow I found the strength to skim through the usual routine that needed attention and be with Gene every moment, hoping for that miracle. I drew on all the resources available. The gruff-speaking elders gave him a blessing. Even a woman in the village who was considered a healer came. Then it happened. By the third day, I woke up after having fallen asleep by Gene's side and saw the treacherous red lines had faded. I really realized Gene would live. It was like a brilliant light came into a darker space, and I felt the burden lifted. My tears were the most joyous and probably even a little hysterical, but I make no apologies. A reminder of this experience is expressed in Gene's words years later. About twice a year, at no regular times, for the 45 years since then, the finger has developed tiny irritating sores, and I remember the wound and the healing. Our lives followed a pretty regular path for a few years after our mission, moving several times for school and jobs, starting a journal, finishing degrees, having children along the way, renovating an old Victorian house in Palo Alto that we were content to stay in for the rest of our lives. We had close friends that were like family to us. Their children and ours grew up together like cousins. It was a good place to be, and there were lots of reasons to stay. But a phone call from a former colleague of Jean's came with a job offer from St. Olaf College that changed all that. In less than a week, we took another big leap. We made the jump from the rooftop together and had a lot more than an umbrella to support us, as we knew. We also knew a little more than those two 20-year-olds arriving in Samoa just 16 years before. I packed up while Jean finished things at school and turned dialogue over to the editor's job over to the capable hands of Bob Reese. Our friends, newly married, students at Stanford, made a huge difference by giving up a week of their time to help us pack and drive the U-Haul and station wagon with six kids, a puppy that Catherine, our oldest one, had adopted the day before the move, and our orange cat. We let her keep it because this was the most difficult move for her. She was going into middle school by then. And our orange cat, Freddie. The vet advised us we drug the cat, and we did, but Freddie gave us the evil eye all the way to Minnesota as he perched on the dashboard of the truck, the only place that he would settle. The trip to Minnesota was eventful with a brand new puppy We moved into a faculty house near the college and were still unpacking when I received a phone call from the mission president's wife in Minneapolis. If you got to say one thing for the church, they know how to track people down. She was asking me to do something outside my realm, which happens often in the church. A little old woman had died after living severely crippled and bedridden for several years in the Odd Fellows home in Northfield, and her request before she died was to be dressed in her temple clothes for burial. I had to suppress my urge to say, "You've got to be kidding." Actually, I think I did say it in a quiet tone and then suggested that there must be someone who does this sort of thing and is more comfortable with it. Well, I got the message that the someone was going to be me, and if I could convince one of the, and as the mission president wife said, if you can convince one of the other three members in town to help, that would give them an opportunity to serve too. I did call, and after three refusals, my friend Jean Jacobson called back and said she would help. It was new and a little frightening for both of us as we carefully dressed the frail body and talked about what her life might have been like. But by the time we finished, the fear was gone, and we felt kinship with this woman we had never met in life. Dressing a body definitely was a unique way to make a new friend that endures. That's one thing that I find appealing and sometimes frustrating in the church. When we are asked if we will accept a calling, we don't always get to choose preferences of jobs or people we would like to do it with, but it's based, nor is it based on multiple choice questionnaire or preferences of jobs to work with. We jump off the unknown each time with new people. Doesn't that spirit of community occur because we're asked to do the tough stuff, sometimes with people we wouldn't have chosen from the crowd? I'd like to go back to an earlier leap Jean and I made during our years in the Bay Area, helping with the birth and beginning of Dialogue. We experienced some wonderful support. It was a pretty exciting time to see the response from people who were hungry for discussion of gospel subjects from an intellectual perspective. Like receiving water in the desert, as one reader put it. We even had the support and participation of some general authorities. Our own state president and mayor of Palo Alto, David B. Haight, was encouraging and saw the need of the journal. We saw pockets of support as Jean responded to invitations to speak to people in the Bay Area on the purpose of such a journal. The audiences were a mix of subscribers and readers, some who were just curious to see what kind of creature Jean was, and some who were ready to attack the journal and the person responsible for it. Jean had a kind of rhythm to his presentations, and about a third of the way through, I could see the agitation in those who knew little or nothing about the journal, or the people behind it, who were committed active Latter-day Saints. I wanted to stand up and calm them and suggest that they just hang in there through the next stage of Jean's talk. It would all become clear. After the meetings, their comments had a common thread. "You are so different than I expected," they said. "I heard that you were some wild-eyed radical out to attack the church." It didn't take a lot to clear that up, just a little time and conversation. But sometimes that community that I find support and strength challenges my faith and understanding to the degree that I'm tempted to shut down and not ask the hard questions. To me, life is one big conversation that we are responsible to continue from the one we had in the pre-existence, which must have been a whopper, given the conversations and discussions about our future lives that we must have had. And the whole idea that we would have that agency to go down and do something on our own. I believe we are partnered with God to use our talents and gifts to keep the good, healthy conversation active. We have a responsibility to each other to engage in a caring, non-accusive way to have understanding and empathy. A good friend reminded me during a conversation we were having about some questions that require more than a pat answer, which is often hollow, dismissive, or based on false information, myth, or even bad practice. She said, a troubled belief is not the same as a disbelief. That is a caring friend who listens rather than stops the conversation. I could have used her thought at a time when my personal beliefs and faith were taking a beating and I couldn't find the peace that I experienced in Samoa or Northfield. Events occurred later in our lives that troubled me, caused by people in positions of power. Their actions directly affected Jean, myself, and our family. I saw a contradiction between the principles they supposedly stood for and their behavior. I had assumed intelligent adult people can talk through or discuss anything of consequence for clarity and better understanding and acceptance of one another. Some people wondered why we didn't jump ship, and I can see why they would think that. But that would mean abandoning a core belief that has made such a difference in our lives. The most profound moment for me to examine where I stood on this issue came during Gene's illness and after his death. The night I took him to the emergency room and sat at his hospital bed, pleading with God as I had 48 years before in the jungles of Samoa, I was asking for a miracle to happen again. The difference now was we were in a hospital with skilled doctors and surgeons and MRIs. Where does faith work in all this technology? I didn't think to ask for a lock of his hair when I kissed him before they wheeled him into surgery. And the insult upon insult, it is the radiation made it impossible to ever get that little memento. Blessings were given that were promising. The bishop told me as he left after one of those blessings that he felt sure about Gene's recovery and the great writing he would get to do. I wanted to believe all that, and I hung my faith on it. The community came from all directions, supporting and strengthening. I watched the devotion of our children, each one. With their particular gift, giving gentle, tender care to Jean. Even at the last, I thought the miracle would happen and he would live, but he didn't. When he died, the world felt alien to me and I couldn't find a place in it. I was fortunate to not be given a lot of reasons for Jean's death from well-meaning people when I knew only one. He had a hideously bad tumor. Because of these experiences, I see Gene, I see God knowing our grief, and I imagine him being happy we chose to come to Earth. I'm glad I did, and I'm grateful for the context in which I've had these experiences, so I stay. Gene was gone only 3 months when I got a call from a woman asking me to teach a class at ElderQuest, an extension of UVSE. I turned her down. She called again, and I explained to her that I wasn't fit to teach anybody. She didn't give up. Neither did my children. Once they learned about it, they were pushing. Finally, I chose to take the job and finally worked out of that deep, dark hole. I'll never forget the morning of my first class, carrying a large folder full of famous artists, along with my carefully over-prepared notes. I took a deep breath just before entering the room full of people, and I felt a rather firm shove to get me across the threshold. He was just helping me take another big leap. Thank you.
I really agonized over whether to stay or to leave, and but I finally decided to stay. Just a few minutes ago, Toby called me to the office of the high priest, but he doesn't have proper authority. And based on the amount of time I was a priest before I was ordained an elder, I think I'll be 101 when I'm due for high priest. The late Scotty Chisholm, author of Following the Wrong God Home, taught at Utah State and lived in nearby Paradise. We both majored in religion at Graceland in Iowa, and were proud members of the one true church of Jesus Christ on the face of the earth. But Scotty later converted to Roman Catholicism. A few years ago, the two of us visited the Logan Tabernacle. The tour guide paid most of his attention to me, apparently thinking that an RLDS priest was a better prospect than a member of the great and abominable church, the whore of all the earth. And as we were leaving, the guide turned to me with his back to Scotty and said, "I hope you can come back to the church." I immediately responded, "I've never been in your church." But Scotty and I laughed all the way back to Paradise. But Toby understands that for me, the question is, why do I stay in the community of Christ? Well, I was born of goodly parents, and my father was a full-time paid minister in the RLDS Church, now the Community of Christ. He was one of those hired preachers the Book of Mormon warns us against. I was raised thinking my church was the true church, and in my teen years, church camps and other experiences gained me a commitment to take religion and the church seriously. I went to our church college, Graceland, and majored in religion. After Graceland, I was offered a job as an editor and writer at our church's publishing house in Independence. Soon I began taking courses part-time at the Methodist Seminary, 15 minutes from our publishing house. I loved the Bible sequence of courses that first year, so the next year I signed up for the History of Christianity sequence. Soon I was into theology, ethics, and Christian social concerns. I eventually earned the master's degree, Master's of Divinity, at St. Paul, the equivalent of 3 years of graduate study. It was during these Herald House years that I began to have serious doubts about the faith claims of my church. The RLDS Church published Joseph Smith's new translation of the Bible, which we proudly call the Inspired Version. But I discovered serious problems with Joseph Smith's revisions. It and the King James Version, from which it sprang, contained many inaccuracies because of new discoveries relating to the biblical languages, and also evolution of the definitions of words. I also discovered that Joseph Smith had emasculated the meaning of some of the core passages of the Bible, such as Jesus' statement on the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." The history of Christianity opened my mind to the great variety of religious meaning and expression in various Christian communities around the world. It also made me aware that our claim to be the restoration of the New Testament church was demonstrably false. The Sociology of Religion course was probably the most important single course for me, but reading books like Richard Niebuhr's Social Sources of Denominationalism and Liston Pope's Millhands and Preachers helped me realize that religions arise out of a cultural context and are shaped by that context and hopefully shape the culture. Courses on Christian ethics and Christian social concerns gave me a greater awareness of the religious significance of social and political issues. I became strongly convinced that the gospel is relevant to the big issues of the day, and I wrote editorials in our official church publications, as well as letters in the Kansas City Star and the Independence Examiner, many of them on civil rights. As a result of my civil rights activism, I was picketed for 3 days at our held publishing house on the main street of Independence, and again at the 1966 World Conference. The sign said, "The commies just love William D. Russell." Now, how sweet it is to be loved. My pastor thought I was a communist too, and maybe that's one reason why I was a priest for so long. I was very disappointed with my church, my church during this time. The church didn't appear ready to modify its interpretation of Scripture, its understanding of history, its belief that we were indeed the true church. And for me, worst of all, our church leaders were relatively unconcerned about the civil rights movement and other social and political issues that swirled around our society in the 60s. The RLDS Church and the Southern Baptist were the two largest denominations in the Kansas City area that did not join the Kansas City Council on Religion and Race. Now, the LDS were too small to be considered here, but a council composed of Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish leaders in the metropolitan area dealing with civil rights. Executive Secretary George Laurent asked me to attend the meetings as an unofficial RLDS observer, hoping I could get our church involved. I was unsuccessful. In 1966, our council decided to adopt a project in which we would go door to door in the Kansas City area and ask people to sign a Good Neighbor Pledge, in which residents would declare that when they sell their homes, they will not discriminate on the basis of race. I was saddened when only one of our three members of the First Presidency were willing to sign the pledge, and it was not President Smith. Only one of the three members of the Presiding Bishopric signed, and it was not Presiding Bishopric DeLapp. Only four of our 12 apostles signed. About that time, I learned from a very reliable source that President W. Wallace Smith also regarded me as a communist, along with Martin Luther King. It was good to be in good company. When I was nearly finished with my degree at St. Paul, I was offered a position on the faculty in religion at Graceland. I thought Graceland would be my last stop in the church. I assumed that if I left Graceland, it would be in some location where church members would be fundamental or literal in their interpretation of the church's history and scriptures and theology. While in both Independence and Lamoni, on the other hand, the church was still dominated by conservative leadership, but there was a significant core of liberals in both places, so there was the benefit of support. Although I was teaching religion at Graceland, I avoided getting heavily involved in the local RLDS congregation. I accepted invitations to preach at the rural congregations in our stake around Lamoni, merely out of a sense of duty. After all, I was teaching religion at Graceland. Sometimes I thought, as I took the stand to preach, what the heck am I doing here? But gradually, the church changed its directions, in directions I approved. We became more supportive of the black civil rights movement and other peace and justice issues. The faculty at Graceland, the staff of the Religious Education Department at headquarters, and church historian Dick Howard gradually convinced significant members of the church leadership that the church should rethink its position on issues of scripture, history, theology, and social ethics. In 1970, five of us at Graceland began publishing a quarterly journal entitled Courage, a journal of history, thought, and action, which was deliberately modeled after Dialogue, which I wrote an editorial in our Saints Herald on the first issue, praising Dialogue and praising Francis Lee Menlove's article in that issue. In that journal, we took positions which seemed radical at the time, but later became positions of the church. In 1970, we endorsed the ordination of women, and 14 years later, that happened. In 1971, we endorsed open communion, and 23 years later, that happened. We criticized our method of succession in the presidency of the church, arguing that our tradition of lineal succession was just as bad as the LDS tradition wherein the senior apostle becomes the president. We contended the issue was which method was worst. So I felt like we should resume the old RLDS-LDS debates, and each of us could say, our method of succession is worse than yours. But that didn't happen. In our journal, we contended that issues of peace and human rights are gospel concerns. The 1984 revelation called not only for women's ordination, but also that the soon-to-be-built temple in Independence would be dedicated to the pursuit of peace, reconciliation, and healing of the spirit. These shifts caused me to become more actively involved in the church. But I think it was not only the church's shift in the understanding of its beliefs about scripture, history, and theology that quickened my involvement. I was divorced in 1986 and found that my brothers and sisters in the church, as well as the leaders, wonderfully supportive rather than condemning, as is so often the case. Some of my LDS friends were very supportive too, and I especially would mention Levina and Mel Smith. When asked to preach after the divorce, usually you wouldn't be asked to preach in the old days after a divorce, but now I felt like I really had something to say and when stepping behind the pulpit to proclaim the word. I had gone through great pain, and now I had gained some new perspectives on life and the nature of the gospel and on the Christian call to unconditional love. Another important influence along the way was my involvement in the annual singles reunion held at Graceland each summer, a six-day reunion. There I found a group of people who loved and accepted everyone, whether they seemed lovable or not. Everyone was divorced, widowed, or had suffered the ostracism that comes from being an adult who never marries in this couple-oriented society. I think you folks are even more aware of this condition than we are. I discovered that in the singles community, and especially at our annual six-day reunion, a community that was truly a community of Christ. Not long after Lois and I were married in 1997, we attended the weekend retreat in Chicago of GALA, Gay and Lesbian Acceptance, an organization of church members mostly. When I walked into that meeting, there I found about a half a dozen of the best students I had ever known and who have ever had, and among the most fine, nicest, most moral, and most Christian human beings I will ever know. I found the GALA community also to be a community of Christ, where unconditioned love prevails. I think communities like the singles group and the GALA group are more spiritual and loving because of their experiences of ostracism. Instead of marginalizing them, we should make them apostles and stake presidents. If the church hadn't changed, I'm certain I would not be actively involved in it today. But I stayed, and I'm more active than ever now. I think the key to this is that the church I was raised in focused too heavily on Joseph Smith. We did so because it served our pride in thinking we were the true church. Reinhold Niebuhr called the pride the original sin. I now think the question of whether a church is true is an absurd question. No institution is fully true. No book is fully true. Not even a book alleged by its author to be the most perfect book ever written. No pope, no prophet, no archbishop is true. Ambiguity reigns everywhere in church and society. We used to see Jesus through Joseph's eyes. His Book of Mormon and his revelations were seen as coming from Jesus Christ. But these were often at variance from the portraits of Jesus we see in the New Testament. And these, the New Testament sources, are the primary sources from the first century. Joseph Smith is a secondary 19th century source. His understanding of Jesus was filtered to us through his 19th century eyes. So in recent years, we have attempted to see Joseph through Jesus' eyes instead of the reverse. And we've not always liked what we saw. We have recognized, as President Grant McMurray said in his Mormon History Association talk at Kirtland in 2003, Joseph Smith was a very flawed human being. Our church historian, Mark Scheer, was quoted in Newsweek saying that in polygamy, Joseph Smith found a theological rationale for adultery. Other church leaders have said the same thing. After 41 years as what you would call an adulteronic, at the age of 61, I got promoted to the greater priesthood, named after some little heard of guy named Melchizedek. In recent years, I've served on World Church committees on racism, human rights, and peace and justice. I am the peace and justice coordinator for our mission center in Iowa. I preach regularly and with conviction. Now, this Sunday, for example, I will speak. I will be the preacher at the Community of Christ here in Salt Lake City next Sunday in South Chrysler Congregation in Independence, Missouri. Now, I only speak about six or eight times a year, so it's not an every Sunday thing. My first wife intensely disliked the church. Lois, my wife for the past 10 years, is in the priesthood and is the worship chairperson for Lamoni, the largest congregation in Iowa. So I will probably remain in the Community of Christ until the undertaker arrives. And at my funeral, please don't assign me to heaven. I have no idea what happens, whether there is such a nice, fuzzy place. I just hope that I can muddle through the rest of this life without screwing up too much. Thank you.
In 1963, at an informal dinner gathering of the Stanford creative writing people, I was sitting on a lawn chair on a patio in Los Altos Hills. One of my teachers, Richard Scowcroft, himself an ex-Mormon, got down on his knees in front of me. "How can you still do that Mormon thing?" he asked. I spluttered something which neither one of us felt was satisfactory. In the 44 years since then, I have been asked some version of that question countless times. Even more frequently, I have asked it of myself. Here is one of my attempts to answer. When I was a teenager, belief became hard for me, and it has gotten progressively harder. I have never been able to say I know about many facets of religious or spiritual life in general, and Mormonism in particular. Despite decades of immersion in Mormonism, despite prayer and study, I feel I know almost nothing. Considering the tentative state of my testimony, considering the world in which I live, my husband and most of my associates are not believers, one is even more justified in asking why I stay. Critic and humorist Joe Queenan has published a book called True Believers about the religion of sports. Earlier this summer, I heard him interviewed on NPR. Queenan is from Philadelphia and has been an exasperated Phillies fan through 10,000 losses. How does he feel about his Phillies? Asks the interviewer. I have hated them since I was a little kid, says Queenan. Don't you secretly love them? Asks the interviewer. No. Queenan admits he checks their scores every day. He says it's like making sure a relative is still breathing. Then why don't you divorce the Phillies? Asks the interviewer. Become a Washington Senators or a New York Yankees fan. Because, says Queenan, people who switch allegiances go to hell. He adds, you have to play the cards you're dealt. I don't think the Philadelphia Phillies are comparable to Mormonism. And the interviewer could have asked, why not abandon baseball fandom altogether instead of just the Phillies? And one of the Christian concepts I have trouble with is hell. Still, Queenan's relationship with the Phillies is a little like my relationship with the church. Sometimes when I'm asked why I stay, I reply, it's who I am. I was dealt a hand from a Mormon deck. At least Mormonism is part of who I am. I am also, I think, from my core, a questioner. I am not able to be satisfied with many of the answers I have been given. Sometimes I am a searcher, seeking with great effort answers that will work for me. I am often a coward, so I have not voiced my beliefs nor asked my questions very loudly. And at times I am a sluggard. A friend wrote me recently, citing Newton's first law of motion. A body will still continue the way it has been going unless acted upon by an outside power. Evidently, my friend continued, we stay in the church because we haven't been acted upon by an outside influence strong enough to alter our course. Both Mormon doctrine and humanitarian philosophies of all sorts say people should be able to change. If I am proud, I should repent and become more docile. If I am selfish, I should repent and become altruistic, or at least less selfish. A few weeks ago, I heard a thoughtful sacrament meeting talk called Why God?, in which the high councilman made a case for believing in God and then said we could will ourselves to make the leap of faith to the hope of eternal life and eternal meaning. And some say I could make the leap out of Mormonism. Many have done that. I'm not so sure about my ability to change my Mormonness. As long as I have a mind, Mormon hymns will run through it. I cannot erase them, even those I don't like. This is the kind of Mormon I am. I grew up in southern Nevada and northern Utah with a Mormon mother and an agnostic Jewish father who apparently agreed that their children would be raised in the Mormon church. I am quite sure my dear father didn't know what he was agreeing to. I have two brothers. One is a faithful Mormon. The other left the church after high school. I love all of my relatives, but because of age differences, personality traits, and geography, I have been, for most of my adult life, much closer to the Jewish side of my family than the Mormon side. I am married to a man who left the Mormon Church in his 20s, a few years after he successfully completed a mission. I pay tithing, but do not hold a temple recommend, and have never taken out my endowments. When I am in town, my town, I usually attend sacrament meeting and sometimes Sunday school, but not Relief Society and rarely stake meetings of any kind. I have said no to many church callings that I felt I could not in conscience perform, but have had for many years a calling that no one else seems to want and that I enjoy. I produce the ward newsletter and write the annual ward history. When asked, I will give talks, but not prayers in church. Because I am what Jeff Burton and Juanita Brooks would probably call a Mormon on the edge, I'm often uncomfortable in the church, but fairly comfortable in my own ward. I have chosen very carefully where I live and what ward I attend. Jean England's inspired article, "The Church is as True as the Gospel," didn't really convert me to its thesis because I already felt the church, at least my little part of the church, was as true as, and maybe truer than, the gospel. In my ward, I haven't had to struggle very hard to practice Christian virtue. Jean would probably think I've made things too easy for myself. The Berkeley ward is not the font of liberalism. In fact, another ward in our stake would be considered more liberal. The high councilman who gave the "Why God" talk is from that ward. The majority of Berkeley ward members are much more orthodox than I. The ward comprises old folks, which we are rapidly becoming, some very interesting families, traditional and non-traditional, though even the traditional, I admit, might be labeled non-traditional in some parts of Mormondom, and a good-sized contingent of married students, most of whom are graduate students at Cal, and many of whom come from Utah, and supply our primary classes with children. We have a fairly small but functioning mutual. We have modest-sized families. We have practicing and retired teachers, plumbers, office workers, engineers, handymen, lawyers, computer programmers. It's a middle-class ward. Almost all of the women during their 30s through their 60s have jobs outside the home. There are a lot of Republicans, but a lot of Democrats. Most members are Caucasian. There are Asian Americans, Latinos, and a few blacks. Most of the members spend a lot of time with people outside the tribe, are members of other communities too. I usually feel welcome at church meetings and activities. Also welcome is my husband, who accompanies me to ward parties, especially dinners where there are vegetarian options, which is most of our ward parties. Our favorite Berkeley warders include a senior couple. He is in his 90s, who, after retirement, served two Peace Corps missions, raise kiwis on their garage roof, and usually sleep in their queen-size bed on their patio. We also find stimulating the company of some of the bright young students who temporarily reside in Berkeley. One couple in their early 40s both teach for the Haas School of Business at Cal. She is a faithful Mormon and an excellent gospel doctrine teacher. He would like to join the Berkeley ward, but not the Mormon church. He has pretty much done that. He gave one of the most meaningful sacrament meeting talks ever presented in our ward. He is chair of the ward activities committee. One of the best things for me about my association with Mormons, primarily the Mormons in my ward, is that some are not particularly literary or academic or sophisticated. They are not like the people with whom I ordinarily spend time, not like the people in our book group, or in our birding group, or my former teacher's group, or my swimming group, or my writing group, or not like the folks in moveon.org. These regular folks aren't much like the Mormon people I enjoy most either. I can't share a lot of my thoughts with them, but I can listen to them and try to learn from them. They afford me a less skewered view of the world than I would otherwise have. It's as hard for a Bay Area native as it is for, or a resident, since I'm not really a native, it's as hard for a Bay Area resident as it is for a Utahn to get an accurate view of the world. It isn't just the Berkeley ward that keeps me tethered to Mormonism. Although I have many good non-Mormon, non-Utah relatives and friends, many of my oldest and closest friends have at least some connection to Mormondom. They understand me in ways that my un-Mormon friends, those without a Mormon connection, rarely can, even if they don't share my ambiguity toward the church. These friends would not abandon me were I to abandon Mormonism, but they are part of my Mormon core. Some of these friends I delight in seeing at Sunstone. Sunstone and Dialogue are two of the reasons I stay Mormon. I am one of the lucky beneficiaries of friendship with the England family, whom I have loved since 1962, when I moved from Salt Lake City to Palo Alto, as did Charlotte and Jean, and Catherine and Jody and Mark and Jennifer. And in 1966, I returned to the Bay Area and got to know and love and babysit Becky and Jane. Not long after that, I met Dwayne and Kay Jeffrey. Dwayne was a counselor in the University Ward in Berkeley, where I relocated when I was in my mid-20s. I am close to many who have divorced Mormonism, but it is our Mormon past that binds us together, so their departure from the fold in an ironic way keeps me still attached to the church. The faith of some has been tried by the historical dilemmas about the Book of Mormon, the lives and motives of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, and more important, what would seem to be exclusion and limited compassion on the part of more current prophets and apostles. One advantage to having little faith is that there isn't much to shake. Perhaps I have been able, partly because of geography, to separate myself from Salt Lake City and concern myself with what I call the really big questions. For me, the really big questions involve the existence and caring of heavenly parents and the legitimacy of my own thoughts and actions. What is truth? Is there divine guidance, and is it available to me? Am I doing what is worthwhile? Am I blessing others? Am I making the world a little bit better for those close to me and even those further away? Because I am so busy dealing with these questions, I don't have so much space for the dilemmas that have alienated some of my friends. When bad things happen to faithful Mormon people whom I love, I am grateful for their faith and desperately want them to find comfort in it. Because I have less faith, I have less comfort. I want them not to lie awake at night as I do, worry as I do, feel uneasy, unsure, as I do. I also don't want them to lie awake worrying about my soul, so I work hard to stay connected, however tenuously, to Mormonism. And finally, one more reason I stay connected. In the early part of Why the Church is as True as the Gospel, Gene tells of being a restless 12-year-old in a state conference, and suddenly, because he was there, this is in quotes, he became aware of the presence of the Holy Ghost and the special witness of Jesus Christ. Perhaps if I stay in the church, someday, because I am there, I will be touched in such a way that I can will myself to make that leap to hope and eternal meaning.
Having taught evolution at BYU now for 38 and a half years, I guarantee you I have plenty of anecdotes that could indicate things of relevance to the topic. Bill says he's been called a communist. I've been called a minion of Satan and several other things. But then it was pointed out to me one day Satan wouldn't have me, and so we didn't have to worry about that too much. There are those who say, well, Jeffrey would stay in a church simply because that's his job. That's where he gets his paycheck. And that's an easy answer, but it's not the one. It assumes that I've never had any chances to go anywhere else, and that's not quite the case either. So let's disabuse ourselves of any subject there. I think I stay for several reasons. One is that I couldn't see any real reason to leave. And the second reason is probably a better question as to what makes me keep going. Part of it is that Mormonism is my tribe. It's my people. I have great-grandfathers who walked with Zion's Camp and Mormon Battalion. It's in my roots. At the same time, I realize that they overthrew their family traditions in order to join the LDS Church and take a new way that found seemed more important to them. And I haven't seen any need to do that sort of thing, though I certainly have seen reasons to alter my points of view from the version of my religion with which I was raised. And let me touch on that for just a moment. It's been indicated I've spent a good deal of time with evolution, and maybe I need to justify a little bit about why that is. We live in a world where we have now, for the last 30 years, experienced one brand new disease every year. They haven't come from Mars. They haven't come in from flying saucers. They come from organisms that have evolved ways to attack the human genetic system after having been for millions of years in animal genetic systems. They make host shifts. They evolve. We all have seen recently in the paper how Andrew Speaker was, you know, put in jail and then put in hospital and so on, and you know, had his freedom severely limited because he was carrying a highly resistant version of tuberculosis. There are others who are incarcerated because we have no means whatever to cure their tuberculosis. Chap in Phoenix who lives in solitary confinement with the air from his room being filtered and sterilized before it's let out, purely because he's carrying a bug that nobody can cure. Well, that's evolution. I would remind us that Darwin made three very, very important ideas, contributions. One was the idea that all living things have common ancestry. The second was that natural selection seems to be a very powerful version for bringing about adaptation. And the third one was not really something he could document. Well, he could, but he couldn't. But it was essentially a prediction that the genetic systems of living things have to be malleable. They have to be changeable. And boy, has that one ever been demonstrated in spades these days. It is said that the 20th century was the world of physics, was the century of physics, whereas the 21st century is going to be the world of biology. And it will be because genetic systems are malleable. Not only are they involved in the evolution of new diseases, but they are the whole basis of our agriculture, of our epidemiology. We use it constantly in the fields of medicine. We use it even in such things as DNA and forensics and proving whodunit for a variety of types of crimes. Those are techniques that were developed from evolutionary biology and have been adapted now for other kinds of things. So I would argue that the concept is a very critical concept. So why do I fiddle around with it, and what keeps me kind of going with it? I'm long past the age I could have retired at BYU, but I still have the illusion that I'm doing something worthwhile there, so we continue. But I think there are two other reasons. One is a sense of obligation. One is a sense of mission. I have a sense of obligation to people who introduced me to data indicating that, as a Mormon, I did not have to choose between my science and my faith. I came of age in university world in the days of the writings of Joseph Fielding Smith and Man, His Origin and Destiny, of Bruce McConkie's Mormon Doctrine, and of people who worked from those. They constantly quoted a 1909 passage from the First Presidency that essentially said evolution is nonsense. And I respect those good brethren, and I'm not here to really disparage them, other than to set the record straight that I know of many, many, many scientists who have left the church because of those writings, and I know of none who have entered the church because. It's been a net loss. I once made the point to a BYU president that I could staff a superb Department of Science at a university level with former Mormons. He refused to believe that. Oh, there might be a few, he said. And then I had to realize from his field that was probably not any great stress. But we won't get any more precise than that. While I was at Berkeley, I went one night with a friend of mine to get acquainted with the institute director over at Stanford. That was Kenneth Godfrey, just a few years older than I am. And in the course of our discussion, Ken said, I've got something I think you might be interested in. And he gave me a copy of the First Presidency's memo to the other general authorities in 1931, reviewing the dispute between B.H. Roberts and Joseph Fielding Smith, and indicating that the First Presidency ruled officially to the other general authorities at that time that the church takes no position on whether there was death before the fall or was not. The church takes no position on whether there were pre-Adamites, that is, human-like individuals on this earth before the fall or not. Those subjects were left open. And I read that memo, and it blew my mind because it contradicted everything I had ever seen, and yet it was coming clearly from a First Presidency source. Before I ever published from it, I called Leonard Arrington, a former friend of mine from Utah State University, and Leonard by then was a church historian, and I said, you know, is this memo correct? Is this story correct? And he said, I've never heard of it. And I thought, well, this is something when a church historian has never heard of it. 2 days later, he called me back and said, that memo's legit. You go for it. And so that's when I published the first paper on Mormonism and evolution that tried to indicate that the church is far more open on this subject than many have thought. So I guess there's a certain sense of obligation to those who have shared some things with me that they could have exploited themselves. Ken could have used that. Arrington could have used it. They both had access to journals I don't have and to writings, but it set me free, and I have to thank them for that. Secondly, I think there's a sense of mission. There is a growing concern among scientists that our society is entering a period of endarkenment, that the enlightenment of 400 or 500 years ago seems to be running its course in a certain way, and that the growth of religious fundamentalism throughout the world is threatening further advance of science. We recognize that we are in critical times in terms of humans pressing up against the resources of our planet, and that only science really is offering any way to address those issues. But with more and more people establishing private schools, whether it's the Madrasas of Islam or whether it's a number of the ones we could indicate in the United States and in Utah, where they want to, quote, control their own curriculum, which usually means we want to teach only those versions of the world of reality with which we are comfortable. We see then a fragmentation of society, a fragmentation that will hamper our ability to address critical issues. We see it already in our own Congress, in our own democracy, for people who you know, we cannot make decisions. And we will, I think, continue to see that. And so scientists are worried about that little point. And so at BYU, I try to help our students understand that they don't have to see science as a threat. They do not have to choose between one and the other. You can make huge problems, of course, but you don't have to force huge problems. There have been many prophecies made about BYU over the years that the day will come, it will be seen among the world's greatest universities, that the great universities will seek after our students, and I would like to just end with an anecdote there. I have not been the world's greatest scientist, but we have managed to recruit some very, very fine evolutionary biologists. They do a lot of mentoring, and BYU helps us with this mentoring. They give us money to bring students into the laboratories. And our evolutionary biology program now is probably bringing in more federal money than they run on multi-million dollar budgets, probably doing better than any other group at the university. But certainly part of the prophecies are coming to be true. The world is not going to be looking for our graduates if we look like Bob Jones University. Let's recognize that. But it might be if we turn out young people who are very, very competent and who are obviously well-grounded in terms of who they are and what they intend to do in bettering the world. It's been rather fun the last 4 or 5 years to see our young undergraduates go to professional evolutionary biology meetings, present the results of their research, and be met with 3, 4, 5, 6 mature researchers in the field who come up to them after and say, look, I've got money for a postdoctorate position in my laboratory. Will you please come join us with your postdoc? And I said, well, I've got to get a doctorate first. I don't even have a bachelor's degree yet. Now, my suspicion is that some of those who prophesied the world might be looking for our graduates probably didn't think it was going to be in evolutionary biology. And I don't know if similar programs have had similar success, but at least we have a young bunch down there now who are very, very good, and I think that sense of mission also keeps me going. Thank you.
We thank our five panelists for the varied and very interesting responses they've given to the question about why they stay. And why don't we give them another hand of applause?